Hello and welcome, Transformation Talk Radio listeners and podcast listeners everywhere. My name is Ellen Stewart, and I am the pushy broad from the Bronx.
She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York. Follow her voice, a straight dog and I. She's the pushy broad from the Bronx, oh yeah. Don't be surprised if you wanna listen twice. Make decisions, find the right choice. Know yourself better, find your own voice. It's okay if you need help today, cause everybody needs a little push. From the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York.
Welcome, Transformation Talk Radio listeners. My name is Ellen Stewart, and I am the pushy broad from the Bronx. This weekly show airs every Wednesday on Transformation Talk Radio and podcast stations everywhere at 2 p.m. Pacific, 5 p.m. Eastern. Welcome to Women Who Push for More. This is where I interview enterprising, self-aware, and confident women who strive to achieve more in every aspect of their lives and have learned to never settle for less than they are worth. Inspiring and empowering stories of true pushy broads whose strength and courage makes us all want to be women who push for more. I am thrilled today to have on my show a very extraordinary young woman who came to me out of the clear blue sky. This is my show, Women Who Push for More, and she certainly is a pushy broad from the Bronx. I'd like to introduce to you a very special comedian, Leonarda Joni. Let me tell you a little something about this very special woman. Leonarda Joni is a New York-based writer, actor, and producer. While she was born in Montenegro, Leonarda was raised in the Bronx after her parents immigrated to the United States. In addition to going to Fordham University and getting a dual degree in philosophy and English, she then spent 2 years completing a conservatory study in acting at the William Esper Studio. Leonarda soon expanded into writing, discovering a talent for comedy and satire. She has written for various web series, television shows, and media companies, providing satirical news coverage. In addition to those projects, Leonarda self-funded, created, and produced a 5-episode, half-hour comedy called Swipe Left, satirizing what it's like to date in New York City. It's full of all kinds of eccentric characters that anyone who's lived in New York for any period of time would recognize. We're going to talk a little bit about that during the interview as well. Again, it is my pleasure to say hello to Leonarda Joni. Hey, Leonarda, how nice it is to see you today.
Oh, it's really nice to be here. Thanks, Ellen. Thanks for that lovely introduction.
So let's tell all of our listeners how we came to meet each other a couple of days ago. Why don't you tell them how you responded to me?
Yeah, so I was scrolling through looking for other podcasts that I was interested in being a part of, and I saw yours, A Pushy Broad from the Bronx, and I thought, wow, well, that describes me. And so I was like, let me reach out to her and see if she's interested in having me on her show, because I am a pushy broad and I'm from the Bronx, New York.
Where in the Bronx are you from?
I grew up in Pelham Parkway, right over off the 2 train. I grew up there basically from the age of 1 until about 14.
Not too far from Jacoby Hospital, right? Pelham area, right?
Yeah, Jacoby Hospital used to be where we used to always go when we got sick or whatever. And there was always like a crazy wait. So not the fondest memories of that hospital.
I actually was married and lived around Pelham Parkway at that time. I grew up in Marshalloo Parkway. This is just very quick. I know most people from the Bronx know what we're talking about, but I know we go all around the globe here. Just to let you know, when I went to visit people in Pelham, there was a horseback riding academy in Pelham. And I used to ride my ride horses all along Pelham Parkway.
Yep. I remember that because we used to go by there and my mom would be like, do you guys want to get on the horse? And I didn't, but my brother who loved adventure was like, yeah. And he rode those horses that they had there.
So how long did you live in the Bronx?
Almost 14 years.
You weren't born in the Bronx.
I wasn't. I was born in Montenegro, which is, you know, in Europe. It's in the Baltic, Albanian from Montenegro. And then my parents moved to the U.S. when I was one and moved to the Bronx. And then I was in the Bronx for the first basically 14 years of my life.
And Montenegro, of course, is off the Adriatic and bordered by Serbia and Bosnia, right, and Kosovo. You came here with mom and dad and your brother?
Actually, my dad came here first about a year before we came here. And then my mother came with me and my brother. So we followed him afterward.
And you went to school for 14 years in the Bronx?
Yes, that was interesting.
Tell me why it was so interesting.
Well, the Bronx has a lot of different schools, right? So, you know, you go to one school for your kindergarten, then you go to another school for your like first 3 years. Usually you're supposed to go to the same school, I think, for like, well, actually you go to the same school for like the first 5 years, and then you go to a middle school from sixth to eighth grade, and then you're supposed to go to the high school. And, you know, I was bouncing around schools all the time because my parents were trying to find good schooling. Like, I was a very bright child. And so they kept trying to find the best school for us to go to. And they ended up putting us, when I got into fourth grade, into St. Lucie's Catholic School, which was very nice school. But, you know, I was kind of a wild kid in the Bronx. So, me and my brothers would always get in trouble in that school. And they'd be like, we're also like ethnically Albanian, grew up Muslim. So they were like, who let these Muslim kids into this Catholic school? We should have known about that, you know?
So you grew up Muslim, even though Montenegro was Eastern European Christian, you're Muslim.
So the history of the land is very different, right? Because I'm Albanian from Montenegro. Now, that sounds very confusing to a lot of people, except that they don't understand that Albania used to be a much bigger territory. Like, all the land that's Albanian land is not what you see on the map today. So the parts of Montenegro that I'm from and that a lot of Albanians are from used to be part of Albania proper. So did Kosovo, so did parts of Macedonia and several other territories. But then after the Turks were kicked out in the early 1900s and they did the peace settlement after, I believe it was World War One or right before World War One, they divided up the territory kind of arbitrarily, which has led to a lot of disputes. And it's why, you know, you had the big Kosovo war, you know, in the 90s, and, you know, you had Serbian government claiming it was their territory when you could prove through the ancient lineage and the fact that it's like 95% Albanian that it wasn't.
I understand. Okay. So here you were in a Catholic school, and I'm sure it was really difficult for you guys to get along. And you said it was you and a couple of brothers?
Yeah, I have three brothers. But, you know, my youngest brother wasn't born yet. So it was me and my two brothers, and we were just troublemakers. It had nothing to do with us being Muslim. We were just troublemakers. You know,
a Muslim family in a Catholic school, I'm sure it must have been difficult for you.
Oh, no, I loved it. I was like, this Jesus guy sounds pretty cool. My mother was like, oh, my God, what have I done? I'm like, well, you shouldn't have sent me there. He sounds like a pretty cool guy. You know, I still like Jesus to this day. I'm like, Jesus and Mary.
That's so funny.
They're pretty cool.
It's so innocent and so loving and so funny. That's terrific.
I'll just tell you the story. When I was in sixth grade, you know, we had a religion class, and I decided to do a comparative essay on Islam and Christianity. And what I, you know, argued for in my essay was that they're pretty similar. They had a lot of similar core values. Jesus is in the Islam tradition, you know, and then the one difference is that we don't see him as the Son of God, but they do give him a lot of credit as being a Messiah and a prophet, you know. And my Catholic teacher didn't like that very much. She was like, I don't like this, you know, but all my other teachers that I had, like in fourth and fifth grade, they loved me. They were great. They were like, hey, if we can save this poor soul, we'll bring her over.
At least we can bridge the gap and understanding in the innocence. I mean, in the innocence, this is where we need to be, that religion has to bridge the gap, not divide.
That was my perspective as a little sixth grader, you know? So I think kids sometimes have an insight that adults can forget because they sort of have been shaped a lot by the culture and they're kind of locked into these fixed positions. But kids are just like, well, I don't see what the big deal is, you know? Why can't we all just get along? Right. Literally, exactly. You know?
See the similarities rather than the differences. Absolutely. Right. So here you are, 14 years old. What made the family leave the Bronx?
Well, it really was about the education. right? Because at that point, you know, the public school system was quite terrible at the time. I was in eighth grade, and the school that I was in, it was literally quite dangerous, where, you know, fights would break out in the middle of the hallway and nobody would do anything about it. To the point, like, one day I remember we were leaving, they dismissed us early one day because it was in October. They dismissed us early because they didn't want everybody hanging around the school later that afternoon, because it was known as like a gang initiation day in the Bronx. And so they told everybody, like, you got to go home at this time. We don't want anybody hanging around. And it was like, that's what they did to hand, they couldn't really manage, you know, because there's a lot of kids in the school. There's not a lot of resources. And so my parents were just like, we got to get these kids into a fairly good school, which is kind of ironic because I actually ended up getting into Bronx Science High School. You know, I took the placement test and I was like, you know, guys, I finally got something that I wanted. They were like, well, we got to go. You know, we don't want you getting initiated into a gang. I was like, I don't think that's going to happen, but okay.
Not in Bronx Science for sure, in a really good school.
Yeah.
It was my sister's alma mater, by the way.
So, oh, wow.
It has an amazing reputation. So where'd you go?
We went up north. So we went up to Brewster, which is in Putnam County. And you couldn't have done anything worse to me as an inner city kid who was used to like socializing, going outside, meeting her friends, you know, doing activities. There was a bunch of stuff that I was involved in. And then we went like, it was like the pendulum swung to this town where you had to drive everywhere. Everybody was like in these little cliques. Everybody was very uniform, which is not the Bronx. And that was a struggle for me, more so than anything I had experienced before that.
And that's how you went through 4 years of high school?
That is how I went through 4 years of high school. I basically survived because I put myself into every extracurricular activity I could find, because I was trying to get the diversity of interests that I had met. So I was on the basketball team and I was on, you know, on the drama club. I do like, you know, we'd have a game and then I'd have a musical. And I was like, what? I got to do it all, because I had so much that I wanted to do and it just wasn't getting met.
So this gave you the opportunity to get out and participate in a lot of different things.
Right, right.
And when did the comedy start? Were you one of those class clowns in high school? How did that come about?
You know, I always hung out with the funny kids in high school, and the sort of outcasts. I kind of identified as that, you know, which was strange, because if you saw me, you'd be like, she's one of the popular girls, right? I was, you know, attractive. I was funny. I was involved in all these things, but because I had so much turmoil going on at home, I didn't feel like that. You know, I felt like I don't belong. I'm an outcast. I don't fit in with this very sort of standard American narrative, right? In the Bronx, it was fine because everything's piecemeal. Everything's ethnic. Everybody's from somewhere. But when you move up to, you know, the suburbs or like far suburbs, right? More rural, you can kind of notice you're different to somebody who's from a different ethnic community and really feel like you don't fit, you know? So I gravitated towards those kids, which were always the funny kids. They were always so funny, you know? And there was something about, I noticed there was something about being an outcast that made you be funny, because you're satirizing the mainstream that is rejecting you, but you're also rejecting as a way to like protect yourself.
Absolutely. I understand. And also it gives you that camaraderie so that you're feeling the insecurity, but you're feeling it in somewhat of a secure place. It's kind of
right,
weird.
Right. You have other kids who feel that with you, you know,
exactly.
But so at that point I was more admiring those kids and participating every now and again, but I was starting to shut down by the time I was a senior in high school. You know, and a lot of that had to do with, again, like I said, it's just so different coming from a very strict sort of Eastern European background. And then you're put into this sort of open society of American culture and going, well, that doesn't fit. I don't fit. And it creates turmoil inside.
Well, okay, I understand that, but give us an example. I mean, you spent 14 years in the Bronx. Your parents were rather strict. How was it in direct opposition to the things that you were trying to do? Because you had mentioned before that you were having difficult times at home. What were your parents trying to instill that was so difficult for you to adhere to and you felt you were going to rebel against?
So it was different, because when we were in the Bronx, we had like four or five other Albanian families with kids our age who lived on the same block as us. So when it would be like, oh, we're going out with the kid, it was like, we know who you're going out with. We know what their families are like. We're not worried. But then when we went here, we were isolated. We didn't have any of those people anymore. And now it was us against the world for my family. It was, I don't know what these crazy Americans want. I don't know what they're going to do. They're going to corrupt my daughter. And a big part of big part of the difference is, you know, it's very natural and normal when you're in high school to start developing, you know, romances, right? You have hormones coming out. You're attracted to certain people. This is a very natural part of your development. Well, Albanians don't really care about natural development. They're like, we don't care, right? And you're not doing that at 15. For them, it's if you're going to, as a girl, if you're going to talk to a guy, you know, romantically, it's because you're going to get married to them. So there isn't this dating and explore and learn yourself. It's like, no, that is called being, you know, loose. You're a loose woman. You're free. And we can't have that. So we've got to kind of now clamp down and be like, we can't trust that outside culture because we don't know any of those people. We know what they do. We don't want you doing that. And so there was tremendous pressure to be a homebody, which is the opposite of who I am naturally. And so it was like, you know, here are my friends doing these really normal things. I'm having natural impulses, the stuff that happens as you grow up. And I have to clamp it down and go, that's dangerous, literally unsafe. You know?
So you must have, so how did you handle that? Did you get angry at your parents? What did that translate into you for you?
I don't think I handled it very well. I mean, I went through a pretty big depression. I ended up developing an eating disorder, right? Because everything gets messed up. Everything gets twisted inside. You have these natural impulses, but now you feel like you're wrong for having them because, well, they're telling you you're not supposed to have them. And why is this so hard for you, right? So now it's getting twisted in. And then in order to cope with, oh, I have these impulses to socialize and be with people, but I can't do that. I can't find that. So you're going, okay, well, where can I find comfort? And you're like, well, what's safe? Food. Oh, I'm going to go do that. Or I'm going to obsess about my weight and then try to get to this goal that's totally unattainable and just stay in this sort of hamster wheel. So I don't have to think about all this other stuff that's actually quite problematic and that I can't do anything about.
I'm really glad that you've mentioned this because this is some of the things that I know that our viewers and our listeners are thinking about. When we have a situation where our parents are putting on us a set of rules and restrictions that don't seem to fit with what we want to do intrinsically or don't seem to fit with the environment, sometimes we take this out and this indecision and this anxiety, should I listen to my parents? Should I listen to myself? Should I listen to my surroundings? And we don't know what to do about it. And when that happens, bad mental health behaviors form or questionable mental health behaviors. We can turn to alcohol. We can turn to drugs. We can turn to food. We find a way to cope with the anxiety and stress of being pulled apart into different ways.
It is. It's exactly what you said. It's coping. You know, people will look at these things like, why are you doing this? And it's like, nobody's doing that because they're happy and they're well-adjusted, right? They're doing that because it's already hard enough to grow up as an adolescent. You have constant pressures. I mean, I can't even imagine these kids these days with Instagram and all this stuff. But even back then, you know, we had music videos, we had actresses and they were promoted, you know, they had really unattainable body types. And it was like, we didn't have like plus size models and body positivity. That didn't exist when I was growing up. So if you weren't like a size 4 with a six pack and flat and, you know, kind of boyish looking, right, which is kind of crazy, you were fat and something's wrong with you and you need to fix that.
And that's a really good message to our young people today because it tells them that everybody had gone through these things and they're not alone and they have to understand that it is not healthy to take it out on yourself in this way. So when you realized that you had a slight eating disorder, how did it over time get better for you? What happened?
Well, it definitely got worse before it got better, right? Because I had sort of realized it pretty early on. I think about like a year and a half after I developed the eating disorder, I came to the awareness that something was wrong, but I didn't know yet that there was a solution. And I don't think I was yet in a safe enough space that I could seek a solution. I was still living in my parents' house. I was still living under tremendous pressure. So I wasn't going to give up the thing that was helping me to survive that because then you're not going to survive that. So, you know, people always talk about, oh, well, how do you get better? And it's like, well, you kind of got to look at your environment and go, well, where's the poison? Where's the toxic, right? Because until you remove the poison or remove yourself from it, you can't even begin dealing with the thing you're using to cope with it. It's not unironic to me that I started finding 12-step recovery a year after I moved out of my parents' house, which was after college. So I was 21, 22. And then a year after that, So it wasn't even after, immediately after, it was almost a year exactly, I found the recovery and I thought, oh, I know why I'm finding this now. It was clear. It was like, there was no way you could go into recovery in high school because you were still dealing with the tremendous pain and turmoil of what your true nature was being compromised in order to please these people.
The only thing you were aware of, the stuff that you were doing to kind of self-medicate, was working for you.
Yeah, until it wasn't anymore, right? Until the coping mechanism takes over and you start doing it even when the poison's not around, and now you're poisoning yourself. But that's, I mean, I had my eating disorder, I think, for about 8 years. That's a long time to be doing something and then all, you know, and then be like, well, this is actually quite hard on my life. So how do I stop? It's like, it doesn't just stop. You don't just stop. Oh, I don't need it anymore. I'm done. I'm going to drop it off. You know, it sort of becomes embedded in your being.
Absolutely. This is a very difficult situation. What you're saying, I can certainly relate to. I am in recovery. I have 35 years clean and sober.
So oh, wow.
I completely understand what you are saying. Thank you so much. And you're talking about recovery from an eating disorder, which is
yes.
absolutely as lethal and as life-threatening as alcohol or substance misuse.
Right.
We're going to talk more about this so we can give our listeners some good, useful tips and suggestions. We're also going to talk about how Leonarda moved forward, was able to complete school, move on with her life, and move into comedy when we come back. Are you ready to transform and empower your life by changing the way you think, feel, and act? Then it's time to schedule a coaching call appointment with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified empowerment coach and recovery coach. My style of coaching is part cheerleader and part drill sergeant, always in your corner and at the same time giving you the push you need to truly move forward and exactly what you need to take command of your life. If you are ready for the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, I am ready for you. Visit my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says one-on-one coaching. Make an appointment today. Welcome back, Transformation Talk Radio listeners. This is Ellen Stewart. I am the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, and you are listening to my show, Women Who Push for More. I am having a conversation with Leonarda Joni, who is a New York-based stand-up comedian. So here you are, you finished high school, you're going through what you have gone through in a difficult situation. Your dating life in high school was, I'm sure, non-existent.
Yes, non-existent.
And then you graduate high school and you're still home with mom and dad. Is that college for you or what?
I went away to college and that was probably the best thing I could have done because it, one, gave me the social interaction I was craving. Of course, my eating disorder did not get better right away. It was actually pretty bad that first year. But then I found some support through like this eating coaches who were very, very helpful. I hadn't yet found recovery. I hadn't yet even known that that was a thing. But they were sort of the beginning steps of recovery because we would talk about emotions. We would talk about what was coming up. And then we would talk about like kind of doable plans around eating that weren't eat nothing or eat everything, which was really my eating disorder, right? Starve or binge. That's it. There was no in between. And for a couple of years, especially from like, you know, the middle of my sophomore year until I graduated, it got better, got a lot better. I was calmer. You know, I was really social with people. I did start kind of dating in like my junior year sort of secretly because it was still had to be a secret.
In high school?
No, this is in college. This is in college. There was no way I could have done it in high school because I was so close.
And we're talking about 18, 19, 20 years old.
We're talking about like 20 when I was 20. So that's like the first time I like dare enough to venture and then really went through like this crazy, you know, internal guilt. What am I doing? I'm a horrible person. You know, I'm such a loose woman. You know, and it's like you kissed a guy and I'm like, you're a loose woman. What's come over you? You know, but I was a very like people pleaser. I was a nice girl. I had been trained very well how to be a nice girl. So my rebellion never came out the way that you might see some teenage rebellion. That's like, screw you, mom and dad, I'm going to dye my hair purple and I'm doing drugs and all that, because that wasn't what my training was. So my rebellion was internal. It was, oh yeah, well, you don't want me to be sexual. I'm going to make myself so fat that nobody is going to look at me that way. And that's really, I think I see that a lot. I see that a lot in my culture. I see it in other like kind of restrictive cultures where, you know, there's this like, you got to be a good girl and you got to be a people pleaser. You're like, okay, you're doing all the right things, but your whole life, like your whole body is telling me something else. Like your words are saying, this is what I want to do and I'm happy and all that. But the way that you treat yourself and your health is telling me that's not true because you're about, you know, 30, 40, 50 pounds overweight or the other opposite, you're not taking anything in that it's sort of like scary. And a lot of like, you know, quote unquote, good girls who are following the rules that aren't, they've never even bothered to examine, end up sort of rebelling by turning inward, imploding rather than exploding.
You're absolutely right. And this is an extremely important situation and very important for our listeners and also some of our moms out there that are taking a look at the young women that they are raising. What right. are the signs? What are you being aware of? Like you said, you knew something was not right. Absolutely. You were taking it out on yourself, right? You weren't openly right. rebelling. You were taking it out on yourself, but you really weren't fully aware of what was happening until you were kind of in college from the beginning.
Right.
Started to go see therapists. So in the beginning, you just know that you have to kind of self-medicate with food in order to make yourself feel better because you can't deal with the conflict. But when right. the awareness comes to you in college, you turn around and say, this is not right. Now hurting myself or drinking my poison, waiting for someone else to die is no longer going to serve me, right?
Right. And I wouldn't even say I even had that much awareness in college. I just didn't want to be fat anymore, you know? And so I was like, okay, well, what I'm doing is not working. Let me get some help. And I don't think it was until I found recovery and maybe like a few months into recovery, like post-college, that I realized, oh, I know why I was doing this now. I can see. And it could have some compassion because, you know, going through those years of the eating disorder, I didn't have compassion. I had like self-hatred and resentment. Why are you doing this? I don't want to be fat. Why are you doing this? Had no idea that there's this deep, strong part of myself that was protecting myself. So it's like a war, you know, as part of you is like, what are you doing? I'm just trying to help you because you're in a dangerous situation. You need this protection. And this other part's like, but I don't want it. I'm young. I want to be attractive. You know, I don't want to eat this way. I don't want to feel this way. I don't want to feel sick.
So then you realize that it is not about gaining or losing weight. It is not about how your parents are trying to raise you and how they feel about you. It's all about how you feel about yourself and how proud you can be of who you are, not only as a person, but as a woman that really understands and is allowed to exhibit normal, natural sexual feelings and sexuality, a sexuality about yourself that you were suppressing. And the reason I know a lot about this is because I felt the same way at 16 years old. I felt the same way. My mom and dad were from the opinion that, you know, prude is should have been my middle name. Just what
right.
it is. And if you do anything, if you expose a little cleavage or you're sitting, I don't know, without your legs being crossed or tightly, you know, with knees knocking, then all of a sudden you're a loose woman. And those are the words that I heard mom and dad say a lot, loose woman, which
loose
translates
woman.
Into today being a slut, right?
Yeah. I didn't want to say it on your show because I don't know what I have the mouth of a sailor, so I'm being very clean right now, but there's a F word that flies out of my mouth like every other sentence.
I know. And we can say that, but we can say slut shaming because that's what kids today go through. And I've talked to, and I'm a coach, I'm an empowerment coach, and I work with women all the time. And I get a lot of young women who say to me, I was slut shamed for the most ridiculous things and their peers can be exceptionally cruel and parents can be exceptionally cruel as well. So I completely understand what you're saying. And I was thin my entire life, except for when I was 16 years old and I gained 50 pounds and I didn't know what to do with it because I made myself unattractive. And that is a really important thing for our listeners to know. Because we protect ourselves so we don't have to appear attractive to the world because that's too much for us to handle. And at the same time, we punish ourselves for our sexuality inadvertently.
What are you supposed to do? You know, you're getting this message that says you're not supposed to be sexual, right? You have sexual impulses. People are finding you attractive. And you're like, well, this is a bind. Well, I can solve this problem. Oh, I'll just make myself really fat. That'll solve the problem, right? Because then I'm going to feel grossed out and I feel like I don't deserve it. Then people, and so here's the thing, people were always attracted to me, but I couldn't see it. I could not see it because I had convinced, like, it didn't matter. In my mind, what needed to happen was enough than whether it was real or not. So because in my mind, I knew I was heavier, I projected how I felt about myself onto all the men I would encounter and be like, there's no way, there's no way. And this is like people asking me out. And I was like, okay, he's just doing it because it'd make up some reason.
And then it would be a vicious cycle because you would self-sabotage and what you didn't want or what you actually wanted would come true. So that became right. The cycle. So I'm really glad that you talked about that because it's really an important situation, but still, as you went on and when you into college, you first started to become aware, and the recovery you're talking about is the Overeater Anonymous rooms, the OA rooms?
Yeah. Those are the OA rooms. You know, I found an amazing sponsor in there right within like, I think several months of being in there, I found this amazing guy who was, you know, he looked like he was big because I think he was maybe 230 pounds when I found him, but I heard him speak and he just had peace, serenity, and clarity. And I was like, that's what I need. I had stopped being like, I need to lose weight or whatever. And I was like, I literally was at the point where I was like, I don't care if I never lose another pound again. I cannot live like this. I can't live in the obsession. I can't do it. So as long as you let me go of the obsession, I don't care what happens to my body. So that made me willing to ask somebody who I would have been like, you're too fat to help me. And then I find out after I start talking to him, he used to be like 650 pounds. So the man was maintaining like over a 400-pound weight loss for like 20 years. So talk about, you know, appearances can be deceptive where you have to look below the surface. And he just was a lovely being of light, just complete light, you know, saved my life twice. You know, once was getting recovery and I worked with him for like 6 years, talking to him week in and week out, like three times a week, you know, doing step work, him helping me through the trauma of like my traumatic childhood and the overprotective, border, you know, even abusive household that I had grown up in, and healing from that, you know, healing that stuff. And then the second time was when I left my ex-husband, you know, because I ended up getting married at 25. And because I had no dating experience, no experience with men, I went and I found a man who was pretty much exactly like my father, extremely controlling, extremely possessive, emotionally abusive, would fly into a rage whenever I would do any kind of acting work, you know, was very, very jealous. But to me, when I met him, I was like, wow, he just feels so familiar. He feels like home, you know, and somebody should have been like, you don't want it to feel like home. Get out. Do you remember your home? But I didn't have that awareness. But he was a lovely, you know, that my sponsor was a lovely man who knew what I was getting into, right? Because I would talk to him about it, but he knew that I didn't know what I was getting into. So he knew, like, it's like they always tell you this, you can't tell people the truth. You have to show it to them. And he knew that if he had ripped the bandage off my eyes, it would have been blinding. I couldn't have handled it. And I mean, that to me is just amazing wisdom to have on his behalf. I mean, he was obviously older, he was in his 60s. But for him to know enough to say, all right, we're just going to have to be here with her as she walks through this process. We will ask the right questions. And when the time is right, we'll be there. And it's what happened, you know?
It's unfortunate that throughout, and I always do this as I'm a life coach and an empowerment coach, we really do not learn by other people's experiences. And we really do not learn by other people's wisdom. We can see that there is a roadmap, but we have to actually get to those landmarks on our own before we can actually pivot and make the change. And that's exactly the way I talk to my recovery coaching clients as well. My approach is to be part cheerleader and part drill sergeant. And even though I'm laying down certain guidelines and telling them, like when you sit in the rooms, you sit with people that have immense recovery, they have the experience of it. We still have to go through it, or you have to go through it. My clients still have to go through it one day at a time, so that when it's so squarely hits you in the face, it's your experience, and then the change becomes permanent. It's not a transient change.
Right. That's exactly it. Because if he had ripped the Band-Aid off, chances are I would have just found another guy who had the same qualities in a different body. Right. And so, you know, he would ask me questions early on because I would call him and he'd have a fight. And then I'd tell him this stuff and he'd go, have you ever considered that your partner is a master manipulator? And I remember he would ask me this question, and it was like he was talking a foreign language. I thought, what are you talking about? This guy? No way. You don't know what you're talking about. And then, you know, fast forward like 4.5 years after our relationship, I, you know, wake up one day and, you know, realize I'm out. This is done. Right. And I call my sponsor, and I'm like, this is what happened. The fight happened 2 days ago. I realize I need to get out. And he's listening to me. He's like, let's see if she's serious this time. I said to him these words. I said, if I don't leave now, I don't know that I'm ever going to get out, because it had happened a couple of other times. And so he just goes, hold on a second, puts me on pause, goes and talks to his wife, comes back 2 minutes later and goes, you can come stay with us. I didn't even have to ask. I mean, he just was that kind of like a loving being. I almost started crying because of the kind of unconditional love. He had accepted me through my whole journey, was there when I needed to be cleaned up, was there to hold a space, let me stay with him and his wife for about a month and a half until I found my new place. And just during that whole month and a half, it was just healing because I could see him every day. I'd go over and talk to him. It was just the most loving thing I had experienced, you know? And I remember when I left my ex-husband that day, I said, never again. I had learned it was, everything started to coalesce. I saw the whole trajectory of my history, my childhood, my adolescence, my father, not having relationships, finding this guy, and realizing all the behavior that I had been doing and the way I'd been treating myself had condensed into this one period of finding this. And I thought, this is so painful. Turning your back on yourself is the most painful thing you can ever do, because look at the pain it creates in your life. I said, never again. I'm never going to turn my back on myself again. And I didn't need to be on the lookout for these guys. They just went away. They went away.
Right. Because you realize, and if you see them coming, you know immediately,
it no longer serves you.
No longer that puzzle piece that fits. You can absolutely see it for what it is. It becomes a tangible thing that you can easily put down or walk away from, right?
Right.
It no longer fits. It no longer fits like a comfortable shoe. It hurts.
Right. Right. And it was, it's interesting that you say that, because about, I think it was like 2.5 years after I left him, maybe 2 years after I left him, I ended up getting this writing job on this satirical news network. And I went in to get this job, and it was like, you know, part-time. And so I'd only go in like once a week or something. And I think I did it for like a month before I realized that the guy was a pathological narcissist and a sociopath, exactly like my ex-husband. And I was like, nope. And this time I didn't run away. I figured out exactly what was happening. And there was a bunch of people that I was working with that he was taking advantage of. He wasn't paying them or not paying them enough. And I spoke to them secretly, and I said, here's the deal. If you guys want to find out what's happening, come to my house on this day or whatever. And I went to the launch party of the company, and I knew that he was going to be there, and I didn't care. I went right into the party. He knew what I was coming to do. And so he confronted me, and I said, if you put your hands on me, you're going to have a problem. And he stepped back, and he was in terror of me, because I showed up at the party in my power. I went up to every individual I wanted to talk to. I said, here's the deal. Come to my house. We'll talk about this. I came in, I did what I needed to do. And then everybody, after I would talk to everyone, he would go talk to them, which made his case worse, because he tried to be like, don't listen to her. She's crazy. She's nuts. But I had developed to that point in my power where I wasn't afraid. And so all these people showed up at my house on a Sunday. I laid out for them exactly what was happening. And it was like light bulbs went off on everyone, because everybody had been sensing this, but because nobody was talking about it, they didn't feel like it was real. And they all resigned the next day. There was 13 resignations that he had from that meeting. And because of that meeting, I actually ended up producing my show.
Is that Swipe Left, which we're going to talk about in a moment?
Yes.
Okay. Yeah. Well, in that situation, right then and there, to me, that is the quintessential definition of a pushy broad, right, in a very good way. Because I am the pushy broad from the Bronx, okay? And certainly you can identify as that. Pushy is my acronym for powerful, unafraid, self-aware, hardworking, young at heart female. And certainly all of those things are true. But for you to have the courage, the powerful, unafraid, self-aware part, to walk into a room and say, I'm going to tell you what's happening. I am going to sway things. I'm going to assert myself here in a way that is healthy, not only for me, but everybody around me, allows you to identify with something like that and actually make positive self-development change, not only for yourself, like I said, but for everybody around you. So that's a marvelous thing. That's really a marvelous
right. thing. Because that really was what it was. Like, I didn't have any sense of like, oh, I want vengeance on this guy. Like, I was at the decision point where I was like, I know what this is. I can just resign, walk away, and save myself. And I had come to be friends with a lot of these people who were working there. And I said, but these poor people are going to keep, he's going to keep taking advantage of them, and nobody's going to tell them. Because they don't have the experience of having been married to a guy like this for 4.5 years. So I thought, you know what? I'm going to share it and they can do what they want. That's all I can do. And that was it. That was my whole intention. I know, you know, that was it.
And it worked. Yes. Many of the women that I've spoken to on my Pushy Broad podcast were victim of either verbal or physical domestic violence. Mm-hmm. And I've talked to women all over the world, including a lawyer from Nigeria who is helping to change the entire country's awareness for domestic violence.
Wow.
And many women I know that have moved out of relationships, one that we just talked to a couple of weeks ago, on Women Who Push For More, who left after a 30-year marriage and finally
wow.
walked down on that marriage. Another woman, a woman who's a close friend of mine, actually moved across the country after a domestic violence dispute. So it seems that we are standing up way, way more than just the Me Too movement. It is stronger and healthier and more self-aware in a very, very good way. And I know that you'll sign my petition for changing the Urban Dictionary definition of pushy broad, which was you talk about the kind of words you don't want to speak to on podcasts. I'm changing that whole definition because the kind of woman that you are and that I've been interviewing are the kind of women that are true pushy broads in a really good way and really need to hear your message. And that's a wonderful thing.
We'll be right back.
Are you ready to transform and empower your life by changing the way you think, feel, and act? Then it's time to schedule a coaching call appointment with me, Ellen Stewart, Pushy Broad from the Bronx, certified empowerment coach and recovery coach. My style of coaching is part cheerleader and part drill sergeant, always in your corner and at the same time giving you the push you need to truly move forward and exactly what you need to take command of your life. If you are ready for the Pushy Broad from the Bronx, I am ready for you. Visit my website, pushybroadfromthebronx.com, and click on the link that says one-on-one coaching. Make an appointment today. Welcome back, Transformation Talk Radio listeners. I am Ellen Stewart, and I am the Pushy Broad from the Bronx. You are listening to my show, Women Who Push For More, and we are talking to New York-based stand-up comedian Leonarda Joni. Leonarda has just told us that she has left an emotionally abusive marriage, and she says that it has opened her eyes so that she realized how important it was to have her own back and to stand up for herself. And now we're going to talk about how she turned that around to become the stand-up comedian, actor, and writer she is today. Let's continue the conversation with Leonarda Joni. So let's move on a little bit and go a little bit further here and talk about the fact that you have given yourself a moniker, the Crazy Albanian. And let's talk a little bit about that and what you're doing with your life. We want to hear it.
Yeah. So I started writing, you know, back after my divorce. It's like the floodgates of creativity opened up. And that's when I discovered that I was funny. You know, people have been telling me for years that I was funny, but I just thought, ugh, come on, let's just stop. All right, I understand. I can make a few jokes here and there. But they, you know, my students, I teach the LSAT. That's what I do as my day job. And people, my students were like, do you do stand-up? And I was just like, no, okay, I'm a trained actress, okay? You take that away from me. But when I started writing this show, which was about a female taking her power back and dating and then finding all these crazy characters in New York and just every time I was right, I would just write funny things. And I thought, well, I didn't know that I was funny. So I did that. I wrote a whole show. I produced the whole thing. I started my own business just so I could fund it. And after that, you know, I had been hearing do stand up enough. And that, you know, my boyfriend was telling me for a year, just try it. And so I did. And I was like, the first day I did it, it was a hit. I had like a complete set of like 5 minutes that everybody was laughing at like crazy. And I was like, okay, well, okay, I think I'm good at this, you know? And it just was so natural too. I was just like, everything just sort of came down, my performance aspect, my writing aspect, my satirical aspect, my social messages. And, you know, I was doing that for a year, and then COVID hit and everything got shut down. And it was like, all right, well, what do we do now? Because I can't, there's no stages to go on to. And again, my boyfriend comes in, very encouraging, supportive guy, goes, you have all these characters, okay? Let's just start doing sketches because you have all these characters here and you need to put them into a sketch. And as we're doing that, I started to do one, you know, kind of based on my parents. It's like crazy Albanian mom who is, she's a conglomerate of both my mom and my dad, you know? And I started to take the pain of like my childhood and like just how harsh they were and turn it into a funny scenario thing where it's like, you know, the Albanian mom is always at odds with her daughter, right? And so we started doing these sketches and I thought, wow, this is really taking off. Like it has a whole market. People really like it. You know, some of our videos have like over 60,000 views, which was like really big for me. And I thought, and it's not just Albanians, by the way, it's like people from other cultures who relate to that, even Americans who are like, I don't even know anything about Albanians, but this is so funny. And so based on that, I was like, well, I'm just going to be the crazy Albanian because I always have all these conspiracy theories that I believe. I'm always like, I'm a conspiracy theorist at heart, always have been, you know, it doesn't matter what side of the political divide you're on. Conspiracy theories are universal. So, and people be like, that's so crazy. You're crazy. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to embrace it. You know, you're crazy. They like to call women crazy whenever we start talking the truth. And I just thought, fine. I'll be the crazy Albanian. I'll be the crazy Albanian who spits the truth that you're not ready for, but you want to hear it.
I have heard some of your impressions on your website. Tell people where they can find you and what they should be looking at.
Yeah. So you can, the main place we release things is on our Instagram account. And the Instagram is Leonarda is funny. So it's just my first name is funny. So Leonarda is funny. That's also my name on Twitter. And you can also check out our website, which is really great for if you want to know when we're doing shows. And that's just www.leonardaisfunny.com. So it's the same thing all throughout. So there, if you go on my Instagram, you'll see we always post sketches there. Post little clips from my podcast, The Crazy Albanian from the Bronx. You can also find my podcast anywhere on like every network. You just look up The Crazy Albanian and it's there. But you know, if you go on my website and you register, you put your email in, you'll get notifications whenever I'm doing live comedy shows, which I do a lot of, or anytime we have a new video or a new podcast out, so you can see and stay on top of the media. Those are the best places to find us. Well, me. Me and my boyfriend are a team. You know, he's kind of behind the camera guy and he comes up with all the marketing and everything. And I'm like, here's an idea. And he's like, all right, let's find a way to make it work.
So what kind of message do you want to leave with us today about what you're doing and how you're going? And if there's something you want to leave for our audience, what would that be? What do you want them to know?
Well, I guess I would say to do whatever you can to listen to that part of yourself that knows, because there's a part in you that's always talking to you, that's saying, this is right or this isn't right, you know? And it takes something to trust it because it's soft spoken. It doesn't yell at you. It's not like, you know, it's not that voice that's like, why can't you just get up and run and lose weight or whatever it is. That's not the voice. So the voice that's saying, hey, I think maybe you should check this out. It's so quiet that you can miss it. But even if you don't know where the road is going to lead, just take that first step and be like, okay, all right, you said check out this show that's happening, you know, on Thursday night in the Village. Okay, I'll just go do that. And then you get to the show and it's like, hey, I think you should go talk to that person in the corner. And it's like, why? And it's like, I don't know. Just go do it, right? And so if you can listen to that, what happens is you start to develop a relationship with what I believe is your authentic self. Your true self, your inner child, whatever people want to call it. And it needs encouragement because especially if you come from any kind of harshness in your background or whatever, it's probably been shut down. So it doesn't want to speak up very loudly. And it takes something for you to start to develop that relationship and for that part to trust you. And for you, your life changes as you listen to that. You know, it's a small seed.
So in other words, listen to your inner pushy broad.
Yeah. But it's a soft-spoken pushy broad, but it is persistent. It doesn't shut up because you know, it took me 6 years to actually go ahead and try stand up. But it was 6 years of this thing going, maybe you should check this out. And I was like, shut up.
Thank you so much. Look for Leonardo Joni. I'm going to have all of her information up on the YouTube channel and also on the podcast. So you'll see everything that you need. The crazy Albanian from the Bronx. I am so glad that you decided to come on my show today. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, Ellen. This has been great.
This is Ellen Stewart, the pushy broad from the Bronx, saying thanks for listening. And remember, everybody needs a little push.
From the pushy broad from the Bronx, New York.